Hey, welcome to the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. I'm Kevin Nagani. National Signing Day was on Wednesday. It's effectively becoming the second signing day in the college football calendar. ESPN National Recruiting Analyst Jerry Hamilton will break down what you need to know as some of the last big-name recruits signed their letters of intent. Later on, we'll have ESPN staff writer Dan Murphy on to discuss Mark D'Antonio's retirement from the head job at Michigan State. He's been all over this story, and we're interested to get his unique perspective on what's happening right now in East Lansing. Before we get started, please remember, subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And don't be afraid, tell a friend. Tweet us using the hashtag CFBPod. All of it helps us get the word out about the podcast. And I want to let you know, it's February, so we've been going at it since August. So the podcast is going to take a little break, maybe go on vacation, maybe go to the beach or something like that. It's appropriate for us to put our feet up. And don't worry, though. We're going to be back throughout the offseason getting you ready for spring ball. That's why it's also important that you subscribe. Once the newest episode drops, it appears on your phone, and you won't be out of the loop at all in the offseason. And finally, check out the latest edition of the SVP Pod. SVP is back in the podcast game. They're dropping new episodes every Tuesday. This week, it's just him and Stanford Steve chopping it up on the Super Bowl. Those guys, they have a lot of fun wherever they go. Check it out wherever you listen to your podcasts. Now on to the show.
The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
Well, the big fireworks now in college football happen in December when it comes to recruiting. It is the first installment of National Signing Day. And then the second one just took place yesterday. The one that I think the traditional first week of February one where everybody used to get hyped up about it. Now it's more like, all right, we're cleaning things up, right? It's your dessert after the main meal in December after coaches have left now and they've transitioned and new coaches are coming in to try and shore things up. And, no one better to bring in than Jerry Hamilton, ESPN national recruiting analyst to join us now to clear some things up as there were some loose ends heading into yesterday, Jerry, and I think we've got some clarity. There's still some questions, especially surrounding a top five player in Jordan Burch, but Treetops, your first impression on how things rounded up for the major programs, including Clemson winning its, its first time ever on top of the board.
That's right.
When it comes to the best recruiting class for Dabo Swinney. And that to me stood out.
Yeah, you know, I think when you look at Clemson, the thing I love about their class is they have one of the nation's top quarterbacks. And what I really like about that situation is that's not a kid that's, unless there's an injury to Trevor Lawrence, that's not a kid that's going to be pressed into playing. They could get him in the four games, keep his red shirt. He's coming from Southern California to Clemson. He's making a huge life change. So I think it's great that they get one of the nation's top quarterbacks, and he's not going to be pressed into action immediately unless something catastrophic happens. And then the defensive line class is just stellar. I mean, when you look at the history of rankings on the defensive line, when you look at those top defensive linemen, their hit rate on getting drafted is pretty high, or being really good college players is really high. So when you look at those four guys they signed on the D-line, it's a good bet three of those guys end up playing on Sundays. Or three of those guys end up being really good college players, and at least two of them are high draft picks. So when you look at that, so they got War Daddies up front on defense, and they got a really talented quarterback. Then I think their offensive line class is probably the most underrated part of that class. Walker Parks is a really good athlete. All five of the guys they signed are legitimate four-star prospects, and they're good at tackle, guard, and they have a guy that can play center. They already have a top center committed in 2021. So when you look at Clemson's success under Dabo and the run they've been on, they've done it without having highly drafted offensive linemen. What happens if they start getting really coveted offensive line NFL prospects? Do they go to a totally different level than they even have been? It'd be hard to, but there still is always room to improve for programs at offensive line consistency and NFL draft picks as Clemson.
Jerry, that is a scary proposition to look at how the offensive line has not been I don't want to say a target, but has not been the highest priority for Clemson. And now that they're upgrading it down the road, it's a scary proposition, I think, for everybody around them. Let's stay in the state here and let's focus. And I brought his name up in Jordan Birch. He's a fascinating prospect, a fascinating story, a defensive tackle. And, you know, he's an LSU target. He makes the announcement where yesterday he says he's going to South Carolina. He's a five-star defensive tackle here. Yet, as the night was going on, he never signed the national letter of intent. So, as a result, Will Muschamp yesterday is saying we've got 24 of the 25 kids, and he cannot comment on Jordan Birch. What is the latest as we tape this? Has the young man committed? Has he actually signed his national letter of intent?
I have not, nothing's come across the desk for me that says he's actually signed the letter of intent, but I expect him to. I'll be surprised if he doesn't. I do think South Carolina is going to be where he ends up. Look, he's committed to South Carolina twice publicly. I mean, he would probably be the first recruit in the history to commit to a place, the same school twice, and then not go to that school. So I fully expect him to end up in South Carolina, but like you said, there's two recruitments that are totally out of the norm in this cycle. It's Jordan Birch and Zach Evans. So very difficult to predict, but I will be very surprised if Birch does not suit up for South Carolina.
Now, we saw some moves in the last 24 hours. Tennessee looked like they finished strong. Texas looked like they finished strong. Georgia looked like they finished strong. Texas A&M finished strong. What stood out yesterday when we talk about some of these power teams making these moves inside the top 10?
Well, for Georgia, they almost were our number one class. I mean, it was razor thin margin because they signed Broderick Jones and the center Cedric Van Pran. Both those guys had been committed. Broderick Jones really flirted with Auburn, but he didn't show up on that week, January 31st official visit weekend. When he didn't show up at Auburn that weekend, it was over. He was signing with Georgia because it was a two-horse race, even though he made a couple other visits. So signing those two talented offensive linemen, five-star Broderick Jones and one of the nation's top centers, Cedric Van Pran, were massive for Georgia. Then they added another three-star corner or safety kid. They flipped from Ole Miss, Darian Branch, to go with a really good defensive back class. So I think they kind of finished up their class well. I thought Texas A&M now getting McKinley Jackson was a big win for the Aggies because that's the war daddies up front you have to have. And that was a kid that Alabama, LSU, Auburn, Ole Miss, Mississippi State, out of the state of Mississippi, they all wanted the kid. They would have all signed him. So that was a huge win for Texas A&M. They got him in that last weekend. So when you look at what does Texas A&M have to do to make that move in the SEC West, and it's not an easy move to make when you're looking up at Auburn, LSU, and Alabama. But if they are to make that move, it's continuing to build the power on both lines of scrimmage. The defensive line's ahead of the offensive line for A&M. I think this 2021 class is going to be huge on the offensive line for Texas A&M. But getting McKinley Jackson and the four-star running back Darvon Hubbard, getting him out of Arizona with all the stuff going on with Zach Evans, you know, and the school's backing out on the five-star running back. So getting another running back in the fold was huge, especially after Jayshon Corbin transferred back to the state of Florida.
Now, what do you make of Tennessee and what they did in Harrison Bailey and then adding speed? I mean, to get Malachi Wideman to flip from Florida State, he's a freakish athlete who's a wide receiver,
yes,
and a basketball player as well. What do you think of what Tennessee did?
You know, I really like what Tennessee did. I like their defensive line class, first of all. Dominic Bailey, really quick twitch kid out of Maryland area. Tyler Barron, he stayed home, big-time athlete. Getting Morvin Johnson out of Florida, who was a one-time Florida and Florida State commitment. So you got one of the better D linemen out of the state of Florida. I really like that. But offensively, obviously, when you look at that class, Jalen Hyatt, who signed early, is really fast now. He rolls out of bed and runs 4.45. He can just pick him up and put him down. But Malachi Wideman, like you said, anybody that's seen the basketball clips of him, he has a legit chance to play two sports in college. And I think that was big in his flip decision. But you get a 6'3", 6'4", maybe even 6'5", when he's done growing, kid that's going to be 215 pounds that can leave his feet the way he can and get up in the air. It's going to be a heck of a red zone target. He's a guy you can just throw back shoulder balls to all day. I really like the talent Tennessee brought in this class, and I think it was a pretty good class as far as addressing needs at linebacker, offensive line, defensive line, and wide receiver. They got a really good inside linebacker out of Georgia as well, so I think they addressed their needs first and foremost, and those needs were addressed with the type of talent they need to truly compete consistently in the SEC.
How about some of the new coaches here? Because obviously Malachi Wideman leaving Mike Norvell in Florida State. We understand that these coaches are under the gun, but Lane Kiffin, Dave Aranda, when you look at Greg Schiano and what Norvell's trying to do, his class wasn't strong. What do you make of these guys trying to make up ground here within weeks' time, assembling their own coaching staff and trying to get hold on to the targets from the previous regime, also bring in targets from their past regime?
Yeah, and so not to get on my soapbox, but I'm not an early signing period guy doing this 21 years. My dad was a high school coach for nearly 40 years in Texas. I don't like it for the fact that you said right there, when somebody's hired the first week in December, you have one official visit weekend essentially in 10 days to save a class and try to build relationships and add to that class. And that is a very difficult proposition when this year nearly 80% of the prospects signed in December. The first year was about 74%, 75%, then it jumped about 76%. This year it was almost 80%. So more kids are signing earlier, and that puts these coaches in a bind and these schools in a bind, especially like Florida State, because the process of hiring a coach went on probably longer than it should have, and that affected the class. But Florida State still had a top 20 class. And I think they added some key pieces in the secondary to it. Getting Chuba Purdy at quarterback was massive. Flipped him from Louisville in the early signing period. Then signing a second quarterback, Tate Rodemaker, out of Valdosta. That was 1A on the list that Mike Norvell had to do, and he did that. So give him credit for that. Arkansas, I think Sam Pittman did a great job. Him and his staff did a great job. Obviously, they got Malik Hornsby, the quarterback out of the Houston area yesterday, and Kendall Browse will recruit quarterbacks from Texas pretty well, right, as long as he's at Arkansas. But what they did was they addressed needs on the offensive line. They got JUCO defensive end that can come in and help him, Julius Coates. They flipped the ESPN 300 safety from Oregon, Miles Slusher, who wanted to stay a little closer home. He's from Oklahoma. Then they got ESPN 300 receiver Darren Turner back in the fold. I really like what Sam Pittman did. They went from 44 to 29 class ranking with us yesterday. So they put together some really key pieces. And it's a tough row now in the SEC West. We talked about it earlier, but from Texas A&M looking up at three schools, but try being Arkansas and looking up at everybody. So it's a tough road, but I think Sam Pittman's off to a really good start.
Your thoughts on Lane Kiffin? Obviously the big splash coming in, and he has an ability to connect to recruits. Did he make a dent early on in his first recruiting class?
I think it was hit or miss. I think getting the quarterback Cade Renfrow early after Robbie Ashford had been committed there a long time and flipped to Oregon, I think you had to get a quarterback in the class. They got former LSU verbal at Demon Clowney, who's obviously the cousin of Jadeveon Clowney. That was a big win. You got to have the edge rush ability. I think some JUCO kids, and they kept a couple four-star linebacker Austin Key, but getting the JUCO linebacker Dalen Gill, keeping those guys in the class was huge. ESPN junior college top 50 corner Lakevious Daniel, he could push early for a starting spot. Three-star defensive tackle DeSanto Rollins. Those are all really good guys to keep in that class, and I think they're going to have to play early. I don't think maybe Ole Miss had the success that Arkansas had, which surprised me. Look, Ole Miss could still get Zach Evans, or Tennessee could. We'll see when Zach officially decides or shows up somewhere. You never know with that recruitment. But Ole Miss did not kind of come out like of the gates like I thought they would. I thought they may do what Arkansas actually did, which is something interesting to look at in the future.
All right, let's talk about the battle in Florida. Obviously, we touched base a little bit on Florida State, but, you know, Florida, you know, what Dan Mullen's been doing, he's a fantastic recruiter. And then Manny Diaz now, when you have Ed Reed as the chief of staff, and Miami got a big win yesterday with Avante Williams, the safety, you know, making that flip, picking a Miami over Florida. What's your impression of both those programs?
Yeah, let's start with the Avante Williams, because, look, we had him in the Under Armour All-America game, and that was January 3rd. So he was down there with us the week of December 29th through January 3rd. And I talked to him multiple times, the kid who we've known through the at ESPN and through the Under Armour camps for years since his freshman year. And I walked away there convinced he was going to Florida. Then Ed Reed was hired at Miami. Now, Avante was committed to Miami as a young, young high school player. Then he was committed to Oregon for a while. But I 100, and this does not discount Manny Diaz and the Frame Bandit. They did a really good job staying on that kid, on Avante, and recruiting him. But without the Ed Reed hire, I don't think Avante ends up at Miami. So I think that was massive in Miami upsetting Florida, because I thought Avante was headed to Florida. He's from DeLand, Florida. He has a couple of young children. I thought he was going to stay really close to home there at the end of the day. That's why he decommitted from Oregon. But yet, without the hire of Ed Reed, I don't think he goes to Miami. So you give credit to Manny Diaz for making that hire. And the funny thing about that is Ed Reed was a coach in the Under Armour game. So it kind of worked out perfectly there for Miami in a way, because Ed Reed had probably got to know Avante Williams a little bit that week. Florida, I love their class. Look, Florida, I think Florida fans, you know, I started in this business covering Texas when Mack Brown was really on top at Texas. And Florida's similar to me in that, you know, when you're used to, under Urban Meyer, recruiting top three, top four, top five classes. That fan base isn't happy with an 8th, 9th, or 10th ranked class generally. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're in the state of Florida and none of your schools have a top five class, you all scratch your head because it's such a talented state. But I think Dan Mullen's top 10 class is really good because they address needs. Getting Princely, I won't pronounce his name right, Umanimelian yesterday was huge to go with 5-star Gervon Dexter, a really good edge rusher, Antoine Powell out of Virginia, and a quick, fast twitch interior guy, Johnny Brown out of Tampa. So they really did a good job replenishing D-line in that class. I think they did a really good job at linebacker with Derek Wingo. Corner, Jahari Rogers, of all the corners in the Under Armour game, he broke on the football better, quicker, and more explosively than any kid we had at Under Armour week at defensive back. Something to keep in mind. He's a high school quarterback out of the Dallas, Texas area who's going to play corner at Florida. And Ethan Pouncey was a one-time Texas commit out of Winter Park, Florida. Has a huge upside at corner. Really good ball skills. I love Isaiah Walker, the offensive tackle out of the Miami area. I think he has an NFL future. And then the big win in January was receiver Xavier Henderson. And he's a kid that Florida State, Clemson, it really came down to Florida, Clemson, Georgia coveted. Everybody coveted this kid, Alabama. But his brother was C.J. Henderson. And that's just not a recruitment you can lose when C.J. Henderson's a potential first-round pick corner out of Florida and had a great career at Florida. You cannot lose that recruitment. And Dan Mullen won that recruitment. And that's a kid, Xavier Henderson, that I'll be surprised if he's not an NFL player one day. He's just so talented. He's 6'3", 180, and he could really run and go get the football. So I think they did a good job addressing needs on the offensive line, defensive line, wide receiver, and defensive back and linebacker. So quarterback is addressed in 2021. I think that's huge for Florida in 2021 and 22 classes. But Dan Mullen's such a great college football coach. I think he does as good a job as anybody at taking the talent he has and putting it in position to be successful. And so whether Florida signs the 5th-ranked class, the 8th-ranked class, or the 12th-ranked class, he's going to maximize those kids' potential.
All right, we're going to stay a little bit in the South real quick and touch on LSU, Alabama. And you also mentioned Mack Brown, and he had a phenomenal start in December, sure, especially focusing on that defensive line. Your impressions of what you saw from wrapping things up, and Nick Saban had a joke yesterday. Somebody asked him about, you know, this recruiting class from yesterday, and he brought up math and said, well, we had 22 commits in December, so we only had 3 today because you can only get to 25. Your thoughts on Bama, LSU, and what Mack Brown has done?
I'll start with Bama, 10th top 3 class in the past 11 years. So on the surface, another great class. I think they Bryce Young could be a 3-year starter at quarterback for them. I'll be surprised if he doesn't win the job at some point in his freshman season. I think that highly of him. Receiver Teo Jones-Bell is another speedy guy from South Florida where they've had a lot of success. I think the running back group was tremendous for Alabama. Jace McClellan flipping him from Oklahoma. I think he's a guy who will be very successful. Roy Dell Williams, the same thing from in-state. That kid is a very physical presence at running back. Watch him pass pro in future years. I think they address those needs really well. Linebacker, pass rush, edge guys. Chris Braswell, William Anderson, two of the best in the country. Demoy Kennedy, linebacker, who LSU almost flipped from Alabama in December, but Alabama holding on to him in-state was a huge win. I think they addressed the tackle well. I think they addressed their needs. I will say this about Alabama. I don't think they are in the position to just select who they want anymore. And that is what you've seen, because it's tougher to win in the state of Georgia with Kirby Smart there now. So while Alabama's recruiting at an elite level, I don't think they're quite selecting like they were for about a 5 or 6 year run. Just something to watch down the line, because I'm not sure their secondary is as talented as it was when they were on their really good run. So just something to keep in mind there. LSU, I thought it was the perfect storm in recruiting this year. Ed Orgeron's a great recruiter. When you take a guy that turns around an offense with one hire, the quarterback goes on and wins the Heisman Trophy, they win the national championship. It's a perfect storm in recruiting. So all the fans were thinking, oh, we'll get everybody in 2020. Watch out for LSU in 2021, 2022, and 2023. That's the national championships really help you the years after that. And they had a number 4 ranked class. They had huge wins in the secondary. And I'll say this, without that turnaround on offense, whether they had won the national championship or not, they wouldn't have got 5-star tight end Eric Gilbert out of the Atlanta area. That's not a recruitment they'd have won when they were matriculating the ball down the field. So credit to Ed Orgeron for hiring Brady in the season they had offensively and win a national championship. And Eric Gilbert committed well before the national championship was won or the SEC was won. He was going there because of what he saw in the offense. So that is what happens when you flip the script offensively and you go from a matriculating offense to an offense that's fun for kids to watch. You get one of the best players in the country. Running back, Kevontre Bradford, a kid out of Lancaster. Remember this kid's name. Now, LSU at one point was going to get Zach Evans. Then things kind of fell apart with Zach Evans himself on the field, a senior year at North Shore, and his recruitment team started backing off. But Kevontre Bradford's out of Texas as well, Lancaster. He has legit speed now. He runs on a 4x100 and 4x200 team at Lancaster. It's one of the fastest in the state of Texas. He's a kid who can hit the crease and he can strike up the band. So remember that name. That's a really good get. I love their D-line class now. I mean, their D-line class will have multiple guys that get drafted in it, and their offensive line class, Marcus Dummerville and Marlon Martinez out of St. Thomas Aquinas, are very good in their own right. So I think they have a well-rounded class there. You look at North Carolina, Mac, what they had to do was address defensive line in this class. And you know what? Tim Brewster is still one of the very best recruiters in college football. And so is Mac Brown when they zero in on a target. And it was Desmond Evans. Clemson hurt them in state a little bit, getting Mitchell Mays, the offensive lineman, and Trenton Simpson late, the linebacker out of Mallard Creek. But Desmond Evans was seen as the guy they absolutely couldn't afford to lose, the 5-star defensive end, and they got him. And on top of that, they got Miles Murphy and Kendrick Bigsley-Jones and Clyde Pender. They signed the D-line class they absolutely had to have, so something to remember down the line as they build that depth on the defensive front and hopefully get a couple of difference makers for him. And they address wide receiver. Josh Downs is going to be a really good slot receiver. I think they had a really good class. The only reason North Carolina didn't have a top 10 class is because Clemson's on top of the college football world from a recruiting perspective right now, and they badly wanted two of the top 3 players in the state.
Yeah, and one of the first things Mac told me when he took over is, I'm building a fence around the state because he wants to make sure that over time that he could be dominant with the talent in North Carolina. That was the key to his success the first time he was at North Carolina. And he you could see he's laying down the groundwork, but while still dealing with Dabo and his success and his ability to recruit nationally. So when we talk about the South teams, they're going to be everywhere in the top 10, but the one thing that is most consistent is Ohio State, no matter what, is inside the top 10. And the majority of the time inside the top 5. How do you view Ohio State and Michigan and Penn State and what they did?
I think Ryan Day, as a first-year head coach, may have done the best job putting players in a position to be successful that I've seen. And I think he almost created that perfect storm that Ed Orgeron did. And look, they go into the college football playoff in year one as a head coach. I mean, that is pretty much creating the perfect storm without winning the national championship. I just expect Ryan Day, I love the evaluations they made on the offensive line in this class and in the secondary and at linebacker. Julian Fleming, obviously, is our top-ranked player in the country and is a real stud at wide receiver. Stud player, stud kid, stud mentality. He's going to be a hit. So I just really like everything they did in this class. Jackson Smith, Njigba out of Texas, another tremendous wide receiver. G. Scott's a really good go-get-the-ball guy at wide receiver. So I really think they address needs well, but that's a program. Look, there's a, you know, we can identify them here. There's 6-7 programs that should recruit in the top 10 every year off tradition, the facilities, the money behind the school, what you can spend on recruiting budget, your TV ratings all the time, how many people watch your game, and that you run your state and your region. And Ohio State's one of those programs. What Urban Meyer did so well when he was there was also recruit the South. And you look at Ohio State this year, J.K. Dobbins, Texas kid, Jeff Okuda, Texas kid. Those guys are going to be drafted really high. Okuda probably top 10. Baron Browning, another Texas kid at linebacker. So in the future with Ryan Day, to continue to be those top five classes, he's going to have to recruit down in the South to bring some of that extra speed like Urban Meyer did. If Ryan Day does that, it's going to be top five classes consistently as long as he's there, because it's one of the programs that if you win, they will come, and there's good in-state talent, there's good regional talent, and if you can recruit nationally as well, you're going to sign a top five class.
How do you view Michigan? Because obviously when Jim came to campus, it was all, he's sleeping with the guys, he's doing these sleepovers, he's not leaving this kid. He's, you know, when I say sleeping with the guys, I meant he's sleeping over the kid's house.
Right.
He's making sure he's around the recruits, and he's going to make a big connection. What did he and what did his staff do during this recruiting period?
You know, it's a top 12 class in 5 years. So they're right there. Are they recruiting at the Clemson, Ohio State, Alabama, LSU, Georgia level consistently? They're right. They're just a step behind that. But you know what? They have enough to win the games. And I think they did a good job keeping guys, some key guys in state, Braden McGregor, Makari Page, Andre Selden. They continue to go to New Jersey, and that has been huge for Harbaugh since he was hired at Michigan. They've had massive wins in New Jersey, including Rashawn Gary. So they got two more ESPN 300 guys out of New Jersey. That linebacker was a huge need in this class, and they signed four really good prospects, maybe five. Jalen Harrell could spin down out of the Tampa area. He could spin down and play DN long term. He just keeps getting bigger and bigger. But I think they addressed their needs really well. Is their class, like I said, right there with those top five classes? Is a step behind. And I think, you know, look, it's been well documented. He needs to beat Ohio State. I mean, that's the only way you're really going to break through and really take that next step in recruiting. And so again, but they're going to sign, as long as Jim Harbaugh's there, they're going to sign top 10, 12, 14 type classes. So they're going to have enough talent. It's going to be, can they get that key win on the field?
James Franklin has a phenomenal ability of connecting and recruiting really well in Pennsylvania as well. What was your impression of Penn State?
He's number 12 ranked class. Linebacker Curtis Jacobs, I think, is going to be a star. I think the thing there is he did a great job in Maryland. He's always done a really good job recruiting Virginia, Maryland, hitting those areas. And, you know, Maryland has the toughest job of keeping top kids at home in any state in the country, in my opinion. Maybe Arizona's right there with them, Virginia a little bit. But so you can go into Maryland and have a lot of success if you're Penn State, Ohio State. And James Franklin has done that. And, you know, Curtis Jacobs is a Baltimore area kid. So they've done a really good job in that state. I like the depth, and I like the consistency in this class. Offensive line was good. They went to the JUCO ranks for wide receiver and corner. Both those kids should be impact players. They went to Canada for a tight end, Theo Johnson, who was really good at the Under Armour game until he tweaked his knee. So I really like what they did. I think they're doing a good job recruiting regions and areas where they can win recruiting battles. And James Franklin, once he gets them on campus, once he walks in the home, he's as good as it gets now. I mean, he's on a Bobby Bowden, Matt Brown level of recruiter when it's time to talk to the parents and connecting with kids, as you said. So if he can get to the kids, he's going to have success, and they sign another top 12 type class.
he does an amazing job in finding also talent on the outside and weapons in the backfield, of course, and what they've done. You know, Ricky Slade announcing that he's in the transfer portal. You know, make us understand this whole thing, because I think people sometimes forget, too, that you can have 25 scholarship players. But at the same time, does that include guys coming in, transferring, grad transfers? How does the transfer portal play a role here when it comes to recruiting and, you know, National Signing Day?
Yeah, it doesn't factor in that 25. I mean, you can back count early enrollees transfers in the recruiting classes. So there's some ways to manipulate that a little bit, manipulate your numbers, and everybody does it with the early enrollees or the transfers. But how it affects you, so this is the way I look at it. And I look at, let's go through the Power Fives. I think you always have to have a scholarship or two available nowadays. I think if you get really close to that 85 and you're sitting on 84 and a couple of kids enter the portal that can be difference makers for you, man, that can really hurt you from the next season. You look at University of Texas getting Parker Braun. You look at him 2 years ago getting the offensive lineman Anderson out of Rice. Those guys transferred in were instant starters at the University of Texas. Anderson started on the team that beat Georgia in the Sugar Bowl. So I think it's imperative that you leave a couple of slots open nowadays, because you never know who's going to hit the portal. And if you have one need after signing day, somebody gets hurt in spring practice that was a key for you, it's always nice to have that cushion if that player is available to go get. Now, the hard part is if it's grad transfer, how does it match up academically, and can you get the kid into your school? And then let's just go to the lower division ones. You look at Willie Taggart at FAU, got 6-7 kids that are going to transfer in. Two of those kids were at FSU with him. TJ Chase was a backup, a receiver at Clemson. There's a receiver from Duke that's transferring in. If you're FAU, you want to have a few spots open because the portal's your friend. UTSA, where one of my friends in coaching, Jeff Traylor, just got hired. The portal is your friend. That's the way you can ascend quickly. You hit on a quarterback and use the portal, you can ascend really quickly at the mid-major level. So there's different ways to go about it, I think. But I think it's like what Willie Taggart's doing at FAU, really going to be good. The portal's going to be very beneficial to him, especially when you see the kids that are coming in the transfer market.
All right, Jerry, let's go to the Pac-12. And last year, Oregon was the huge storyline and how they finished up and how they gobbled up a ton of talent in Southern California. And yep. that used to be USC's dominant playground. And they didn't sign a recruit yesterday, USC. They didn't sign a quarterback for the first time since 2012. They didn't finish in the top 50 of the rankings from ESPN. 8 Pac-12 teams made the top 50, and USC was behind a school like Oregon State. What is going on with USC and recruiting right now?
I think it's very negative out there. Talking to kids like I do, it's just a very negative mindset right now. A lot of the guys don't think Clay Helton's going to make it long term, which sounds crazy. And I just think there's a negative vibe, you know. For me in recruiting, it's kind of simple. If you're the cool school, kids go there. I mean, your hometown, your kids in state stay around if one of the schools in state's the cool school. Right now, USC's not the cool school to these kids, and that matters. I know that's a simplistic way to say it, but if you think about this, what USC and what all the Pac West Coast schools are up against right now in recruiting. And they're doing a fine job. Look, Oregon's doing a great job. Washington did a great job keeping their class together. But I always say this about recruiting. The age of influence for kids is like 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. And when those kids are turning on the TV and watching college football, they identify with a player and they identify with teams. So if you're on the West Coast now trying to keep all those kids home, those kids are accustomed to seeing Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, Notre Dame in the playoffs. They're seeing other teams win the national championship and go to the playoff. All those kids are winning the major awards in college football. They have more high draft picks at those schools than other schools do in conference, for sure. And some of that's due to sheer numbers in the SEC, having 14 schools in the most talented region in the country. But it's what kids see. And so you're recruiting against that right now. And so if there is any question marks around your program, good luck. I mean, and when you think about it, Bryce Young and DJ, two of the top quarterbacks in the country, go to Alabama and Clemson from Southern California. That kind of goes to my point, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just stunning. Maybe I'm a traditionalist. To me, you're always still USC, right? And yeah, especially in Southern California with all that talent, USC's may not be on a national scale, like you mentioned these other programs right now, but wherever USC were to go, when you see the colors and you look at the tradition, it's USC.
Our thoughts on USC are Snoop Dogg on the sidelines, Pete Carroll, Reggie Bush, Matt Leiner, all those guys. That's what we think about, right?
Yep.
And we think about all that tradition at USC. I think the memories are so short nowadays with these kids. But here's the other thing with USC. This is one class for them. Look, early on in Helton's tenure there, they're recruiting really, really high level. They have a lot of good players coming back. And one of the reasons they didn't sign a quarterback this year is because after the injury early on to the starting quarterback, Keaton Slovis, the freshman out of Arizona, comes on and looks really good. So one of the reasons you don't get a quarterback in this class is because the guys you wanted don't see a path to be the starter. And so they're going to find a different path. Like Bryce Young thought the path that Alabama, and I think he's right, is a better path than the path at USC to be the starter. And he's going to a program that's won more consistently. So I think that's kind of what you're battling. But USC's had good classes in the past under Helton, and they have a lot of talent in the program. It's not a depleted program by any means. But what happens when you have an off class is everybody else catches up to you pretty quick.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. And we'll end this conversation because, Jerry, you've been fantastic. On Notre Dame, and that is one of those on the same level of USC when you look at the history and the expectations year in, year out, regardless of who the coach is, you believe that they will still maintain a top 20 class. They finished 14th. They didn't get a recruit yesterday, but what happened with Landon Bartleson, and where when you look at Notre Dame, where did they target and what did they do so well?
Yeah, I think they recruit the offensive line tremendous every year, and I think it's always going to be that way. They continue to sign really good offensive line prospects, and that's always going to give them a chance to be really good. Drew Pine, a quarterback that they signed out of Northeast, I think he throws the football really well. We'll see if he's as good an athlete, underrated athlete like Ian Book is, a pocket athlete, let's say, to keep a play alive and make a throw. But Pine has similar arm talent, a similar size kid, maybe a little undersized. Chris Tyree going there from Virginia. Now this kid can really run. Now he rolls out of bed and runs 4.4. Now he's really fast. So he's going to be a nice gadget weapon and be a factor in the return game. I think they've addressed needs really well at Notre Dame in this class. And look, Notre Dame's similar to a Florida, to a Texas, to some of those programs. If you don't recruit a top 5-6 class, top 7 class, the fan base is kind of like, we didn't really have a good year. But if you consistently recruit classes around the top 10, you're good enough to win almost all the games. And again, the issue with Notre Dame is, you know, when they got blown out by Alabama and then last year in the close loss at Georgia's, it just seems like they're two or three players away, those playmakers, that elite difference maker playmaker away. And we'll see if a kid like Chris Tyree, maybe they hit a home run there and he can be that guy for them.
Good stuff, Jerry. We do appreciate it. We were expecting a 20-minute conversation, and I told Taylor, let's just keep on going because the information was great. You can follow Jerry Hamilton, ESPN National Recruiting Analyst, at Hamilton ESPN. That's on Twitter. Really appreciate it. You can enjoy a little vacation now, and then hopefully by then, when you get back from vacation, we'll have an answer on Jordan Birch.
Yeah, and Zach Evans. We'll see.
And Zach Evans. All right, Jerry, thank you again.
All right, later.
You know, one of the big stories outside of recruiting this week is the shocking news that Mark D'Antonio is stepping down as the head coach at Michigan State after 13 years, saying he wants to spend more time with his wife and his children. But this news comes, you know, one day after former Michigan State recruiting director Curtis Blackwell filed an update in an ongoing lawsuit claiming that D'Antonio and the Spartans committed multiple NCAA recruiting violations. Blackwell saying D'Antonio helped arrange jobs for multiple high-level recruits. And of course, that is against NCAA rules because Blackfoot was not an on-field coach while he was involved in these recruiting visits. There's a lot of stuff to unpack here. It's great to have Dan Murphy, ESPN college reporter, joining us, who's been covering this story. He was in East Lansing just a couple days ago when D'Antonio made the announcement and also the press conference. So Dan, he's denying it. He's denying that the lawsuit had zero impact, but it's hard to ignore the timing of this announcement, especially a day before signing day. And then just this happens just weeks after that retention bonus of over $4 million. What more can you tell us about the story?
Right. I think the biggest question that everyone had when D'Antonio made this announcement is why now? I don't think it was a huge shock that this might be his last season. You know, just set the school record for most wins ever as a coach. He's in his 60s. It was people were wondering when he was going to be ready to step away. But the timing of it in February is obviously a strange one. So the lawsuit has been something that's been going on for the entire 2019 football season and a little bit before that. So there's been not only some recruiting violation allegations, but also some allegations that D'Antonio ignored some very specific warnings about a player, Austin Robertson, who had a history of sexual violence. And then that, you know, within a year of Robertson being on campus, he was charged with raping a fellow student. So some heavy stuff for D'Antonio there. And you could tell Tuesday night when he announced, you know, he had a press conference to announce he was leaving, that he had been worn down by all of the off the field stuff that's come across his desk. He said as much on Tuesday night. So there's that. There's the retention bonus, as you mentioned, that he got about 2 weeks ago, that Bill Beekman, their athletic director, confirmed that they are going to give him that $4.3 million check. And, you know, beyond that, there's also on the field, there's been a couple seasons for the Spartans. They've been 7-6 in back-to-back years, and people have been wondering if D'Antonio is a little too stubborn with some of his staff changes and being able to willing to try new things.
Yeah, you mentioned staff changes. The staff changes were no firings. It was just different positions. You're just moving the pieces around in different roles. And he took a ton of heat for that. Mike Tressel now takes over. Where are they going to go with this? Because, listen, D'Antonio in the last couple of years, it's been tough in East Lansing. It is hard to ignore, though, his success. He led them to the college football playoff. He made Michigan State relevant. And when you look at the history of Michigan State, he's the best coach. He's the best coach in the program's history. And where do they go from here, especially now the timing as we are now finishing up the first week of February?
Yeah, there's no doubt that he elevated that program to a level that it's really never been at in modern football era. You know, not since the 60s, right, that they were competing for national championships, and they were right there for a couple of years. You know, how it ended probably is not the way he would have drawn it up. They seem to have taken a step backwards in the past couple of years. And I think that they, you know, that some fresh blood might be good for that program. And it'll be interesting to see what direction they go in. You know, I think that one thing that Bill Beekman mentioned when talking about their coaching search the other night was that they wanted somebody that knows the territory. And I think that means both sort of understanding the Midwest and understanding what kind of football it takes to win at Michigan State and how D'Antonio had success and what he was able to do to bring that program up a couple notches. So, you know, with that in mind, there's some obvious names that I think have been thrown around plenty here in the past week. Pat Narduzzi, who was a D'Antonio assistant for a long time. And then Luke Fickell, who's a, you know, former Ohio State player, Ohio State coach for a year, and has done a great job at Cincinnati over the past couple of years. So we'll see. It'll be interesting. I think, you know, obviously they want to make a hire as soon as possible because of the timing of this. It makes it really tricky. And people are also wondering if, you know, I'm sure any head coach who's considering taking this job wants to know, is this lawsuit that Curtis Blackwell, the former recruiting director, is bringing, is there going to be more things that come out? Are there going to be more problems they have to deal with? Because no one wants to walk into a situation where they're going to inherit some NCAA sanctions or restrictions as well. So that's a tricky spot that the Michigan State program is in right now, that they have to figure out how to hire somebody, whether they want to do that immediately or take their time and let Mike Tressel have a while to see if he can run them and keep them moving in the right direction.
Narduzzi said about the rumors, squash them, whatever you want to call it. He was emphatic about that. I'm here at Pitt. I want to be here at Pitt. And Fickell has said that no one has reached out or he hasn't talked to anyone at Michigan State other than Mark D'Antonio. So we'll see how this plays out, because then this is the domino effect, because if it is a guy like Narduzzi, then you're affecting Pitt. If it's Fickell, you're affecting Cincinnati. So there is a domino effect on a decision like this down the road. How about the entire culture at Michigan State right now? When we talk about the Larry Nassar and the scandal and what they had to deal with, and this hovering over the program with this lawsuit, where is Michigan State with their board of trustees, their sports, department, their athletic department? Where are they with this? Was this just a point in we want to try to move on, and we've got to this scandal and these rumors, we've got to try to move on now from here on out. Do you think that played a role in this decision with D'Antonio?
I don't think D'Antonio stepping away had anything to do with the sort of the cumulative effect of what's gone on there the past few years. I think it wore him down. I think having to talk about it and think about it for the past few years added to the already long, stressful type of days that any head coach has to deal with. But I think it has contributed in a sense that there is a pretty large void of experienced leadership at the university right now. They just have a new university president who's just getting settled in East Lansing, who doesn't have experience running a university that has Division I sports. They've got an athletic director who's 2 years into the job now, but has never worked in college sports in any facet before taking that job, amid the Nassar fallout. And with D'Antonio gone, it's really the only guy who's been around for a significant amount of time that's in a position of leadership is Tom Izzo right now. It'll be interesting that this Izzo is probably going to have a say or a word of advice to add to who they hire as a football coach, because he's been around long enough that people turn to him for that kind of advice. So the trustees, ultimately are the ones who have to sign off on hiring a new football coach at Michigan State. That's the way they're set up. But I think they're at a place where they need to reset, and they don't have a lot of people with long-term institutional knowledge around to help them do that. That might be a good thing to get a fresh start, but it also makes it more of a challenge for those folks.
What was the vibe on campus this week? With the news, how is it being received by people that you've interacted with?
Yeah, awkward might be the right word. I think because a lot of people appreciated what D'Antonio did on the field and what he did for elevating the program and the university, in a sense, through that. So I think, D'Antonio at one point during his press conference said, "Hey, this is a celebration." I can tell you it certainly did not feel like a celebration for much of the night. He even came out at halftime of the basketball game they had that night and said a few quick words, but they were very sparse and very quick. And, I think the fans of Michigan State appreciate D'Antonio and what he did for the school, but he's obviously leaving under terms that they wish were better, both because of some of the allegations that are on him as he walks away and because of the spot he puts the program in by leaving at this time of year.
Good stuff, Dan. You can follow Dan on Twitter, Dan Murphy, ESPN. We do appreciate the time and shedding some light on what's going on in East Lansing.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right, that'll do it here on the College Football Podcast. I want to thank ESPN National Recruiting Analyst Jerry Hamilton. Really good insight. He didn't really catch a break there. We just rapid fire on a bunch of teams around the country, and he knew it all. Really enjoyed it. Also, it was great to have Dan Murphy, college football reporter, join us with his insight on Mark D'Antonio and the very latest at Michigan State. Again, want to remind you guys, it's been great. We've been at it since August, so we're going to take a little break here in February and, of course, get you ready for spring ball. The podcast will be coming back, but just maybe a week or two off. Until then, hang in there and enjoy the rest of winter, and let's just hope our boy Phil was right that spring's right around the corner. And also, always a big thank you to our outstanding producer, Taylor Schwenk, who keeps this thing together.